All rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable Robert N. Davis presiding. All our business before this court draw near and you shall be heard. God bless the United States and this Honorable Court. Please be seated.
Good morning. I am Chief Judge Davis. To my right is Judge Lance. To my left is Judge Sholin. We're here today in the matter of Richard Doucette against Robert McDonald, the Secretary of the Department of Veterans Affairs. Docket number 15-2818. Would counsel for both parties please note your appearance for the record? Thank you. Good morning. Are both parties ready to proceed? Each party will have 30 minutes to present your respective arguments. Counsel for the appellant, do you wish to reserve a portion of your time for rebuttal?
I do, Your Honor. May I have 10 minutes for rebuttal?
Mr. Stoltz, you may proceed.
Good morning, Chief Judge Davis, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. Martinac, along with this Court's case law concerning proper extra-scheduler analysis, require the Board, and not just VA examiners, to discuss the functional effects of service-connected hearing loss when addressing referral for an extra-scheduler evaluation. The law requires that the Board discuss functional loss for the same reason that examiners must address it. Functional loss is part of the veteran's full disability picture as contemplated in 38 CFR sections 3.321, 4.1, 4.10, and many of this Court's decisions. And because of its statutory command to provide adequate reasons or bases, the Board must address functional loss in the same way that it must address all relevant laws and facts, explains what it deems relevant and why, and how it reached its conclusion. Martinac recognizes this. It linked the audiologist's description of the functional effects to the Board's extra-scheduler determination, noting that one facilitates the other. The Board agreed that the problems Mr. Doucette described cannot be converted into pure tone thresholds or speech discrimination percentages. But it did not compensate him for that functional loss or explain why it did not constitute functional loss. Had the Board properly interpreted and applied the law, it would have discussed his disability picture outside of his pure tone decibel loss.
Mr. Stoltz, in the record, in the Board decision, actually I'm looking at pages 10, 11, 12, there's a fairly lengthy discussion of extra-scheduler functional impact. And your brief indicates that this was cursory discussion. Could you explain to me how you view the material that the Board member discussed on those pages in the decision?
Well, Your Honor, the Board, as you point out, has a long, lengthy extra-scheduler section. It's short on analysis, however. It properly lays out the law. It discusses some of the things that Mr. Doucette suffers because of his hearing loss, but then offers no true analysis of that. The Board, in fact, in this decision, recognizes this a bit. And it recognizes this when it says on page 11 of the record 10 of the Board decision that the only other severity of his bilateral hearing loss are his lay symptoms, but those can't be converted into pure tone decibel loss. So they recognize that. The Board recognized that in this case. It moves to an extra-scheduler analysis, and it lists some of the things Mr. Doucette suffers from. It does not necessarily get into the fact that in February 2013, He noted the examiner marked yes to employment problems. It didn't really get into what those employment problems would be, despite the fact that they had it, that the board did afford Mr. Doucette an opportunity for a hearing. It did not get into the functional effects of the embarrassment caused as described by Mr. Doucette in his board hearing. And in fact, at page 13 of the record, the board summarily says at the end of it, because the rating criteria are adequate, referral for consideration of the assignment of an extra scheduler rating is not warranted. Discussion of whether there are related factors, therefore, is unnecessary. The board seems to be, it is less than clear, but the board seems to be at that point saying, we could go into more of a discussion of this, but we're not going to, because the scheduler criteria take care of it. And that's the fundamental problem in this case. The scheduler criteria do not take care of it.
Now, are you arguing that it doesn't take care of it because these are symptoms that are not contemplated by the rating schedule or because of the severity of the symptomatology presented under them?
I think both, Your Honor. Both would render this inadequate. Each is an independent basis as to why this is inadequate, but both. Both because the board didn't truly get into the symptoms and the practical effects that these symptoms cause. But the main problem is that under this court's decision in Thun, it didn't do step one or step two correctly. It didn't really get into what his disability picture is, what his disability picture was causing him, or what effects there could be on employment or something like that, even though it had the opportunity to ask these questions at a board hearing. And it had the opportunity to flesh this out and perhaps and at least refer it for extra scheduler evaluation, even if it did not discuss this in its own decision.
Based on the diagnostic code and the rating schedule, clearly loss of ability to hear is what is compensated, is contemplated and compensated. So what is it that you're saying that the rating schedule isn't addressing?
In Mr. Doucette's case, the rating schedule is not compensating him for the accommodations that he may need at work. It is not compensating him for the embarrassment caused by his hearing loss. It is not compensating him for his inability to hear in noisy crowds and the social problems that may or may not cause Mr. Doucette. It is not compensating him for that February 2013 checkmark that this affects his employment. It is not compensating him. In fact, it's not compensating him. He has a non-compensable evaluation due to the scheduler criteria.
If we were to accept your approach to the interpretation of what the rating schedule contemplates and doesn't contemplate, would we be required to extend that to other diagnostic codes? I think the secretary, for example, mentions the limitation of motion, range of motion, kind of, you know, the musculoskeletal kind of disabilities that, oh, well, somebody has trouble pulling on their jacket or somebody has trouble lifting their kids up or something. Would you expect that those rating schedule diagnostic codes would also be subject to the similar interpretation?
Yes, Your Honor. And in fact, I don't know that the court needs to break any real new ground there except for to clarify that. The court's most recent decisions since the Martinat case have dealt a lot with extra scheduler analysis. We've cited many in our briefs and in supplemental pleading. Kupamala, Wages, Yancey, Thun. All of these came out since the Martinat decision, and so it is apparent that the court is wrestling a bit with this extra scheduler evaluation. So my answer is yes, absolutely. When the diagnostic criteria speak to a rote analysis, the extra scheduler analysis becomes so very important because as the CFR itself recognizes, these are individual veterans. Each person is different, and the effects of the disabilities are different. And so a robust extra scheduler analysis is contemplated in the Secretary's very own regulations and in this court's case law.
So the shortcoming is in the analysis. You're not necessarily stating that Mr. Doucette would actually receive an extra scheduler evaluation for this.
There's no way, I believe, in this setting that we can get there because the board hasn't offered that analysis, so we have nothing to go on. So it would have to be offered in the first instance by the board. That's why remand is necessary in this case. Otherwise, I suppose we'd be up here arguing for reversal. But there's nothing to do yet because the board hasn't done its job.
Counselor, you referenced Martinat previously, which is a well-thought-out opinion, in my opinion.
Interesting you say that, Your Honor.
It was yours, wasn't it? But the requirements mentioned there are placed upon VA examiners and not the board. Isn't that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
So what you're suggesting is that we extend Martin Act to the board. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor, and I think it's a very logical extension. Because why have the examiners render this analysis if the board gets to simply ignore them, or the board gets to simply mention them in passing and then offer no true analysis? It's a very logical extension. Also, as I was discussing with Judge Scholin, there has been ample intervening case law, not necessarily on hearing loss, of course, but on extra-scheduler evaluations, and it's becoming more and more evident that the law requires, and the law has always required, VA to conduct this extra-scheduler analysis. So it is an extension of Martin Act, Your Honor, but it totally comports with this law, with this court's case law and with the way the plain language of the regulations read.
Counsel, the regulation section 3.321B1 sets out the criteria for going to extra scheduler. Are you suggesting that the extra scheduler analysis should be done for all hearing loss cases?
Yes. The extra scheduler analysis should be done by the Board of Veterans' Appeals in any case. The extra scheduler analysis is part and parcel of a board adjudication. Whether it warrants extra scheduler consideration is something that the board gets to decide, but it must support itself with adequate reasons or basis. The Kupamala decision that we submitted as supplemental authority speaks to this, as well as the Matthews, neither of these are directly on point, but I believe that they show some context as to what needs to be done for a board's adequate evaluation. So, yes, Your Honor.
And 3.321B then has triggers for extra scheduler. And let me just quote one of the paragraphs on the criteria. To accord justice, therefore, to exceptional case, where the scheduler evaluations are found to be inadequate, the Undersecretary for Benefits or Director of Compensation Service, upon field station submission, is authorized to approve, on the basis of the criteria set forth in this paragraph, an extra scheduler evaluation commensurate with the average earning capacity impairment due exclusively to the service-connected disability or disabilities. And then it goes on to talk about the governing norms. Mm-hmm. Is a finding that the case presents such an exceptional or unusual disability picture with such related factors as marked interference with employment or frequent periods of hospitalization as to render impractical the application of the regular scheduler standards. So how is it that any hearing loss case would meet the exceptional or unusual disability picture?
Not every hearing loss case will meet it, but the board must discuss why it does not meet it before it decides not to refer it for extra scheduler analysis. And what we are arguing in this case is that the board did not do this. Had the board done this, it would have discussed the fact that there is an effect on employment. We don't know. The board doesn't know. The board has a conclusion about it, but the board offers no analysis as to what effect on employment that is. There's a social component. He's embarrassed because he has a hard time hearing in crowds or social situations like that. So there's a social component, which is contemplated in other areas of the diagnostic code. And so because Mr. Doucette has some conditions outside of this pure tone decibel loss, and again, Your Honor, is not being compensated for his hearing loss, it becomes imperative that the board conduct a rigorous analysis of this. If it comes to a conclusion after a true analysis and after truly running through this court's case law and the regulations on point that extra scheduler referral is not necessary, the board can do that. But in this case, the analysis is so short, given the actual evidence of record, and given the board's own admission that the scheduler criteria could not contemplate his lay testimony, which it found to be competent and credible, this extra scheduler analysis is deficient.
VA relies in their supplemental briefing on a 2002 physician's guide was instructive to VA doctors in how to conduct exams. And it talked about, for this kind of decibel loss, it translates into this type of difficulty hearing, you know, in a noisy room or wouldn't even be able to hear in a quiet room or whatever. So doesn't that match up with the kinds of difficulties that you're talking about that Mr. Doucette has, that VA has thought about when we say you're going to get in the tables in this kind of range of hearing loss, that this is what it translates into real life?
Notably, that 2002 evidence is before the 2007 decision in Martinac, which explicitly recognized that the rating schedule was rotely applied to the decibel hearing loss. So that is important, I believe, to answer Your Honor's question. But to also answer that, no. Anything that is in the Secretary's supplemental pleading, and certainly the Secretary has the right, and Martinac clearly recognized this, the Secretary has the right to conduct the tests as he sees fit as far as the scheduler criteria are concerned and the pure tone, decibel hearing loss, et cetera. But it does not contemplate, nowhere in the Secretary's pleading did I see that it contemplates embarrassment. Nowhere did I see that it contemplated effects on employment. Those are specifically dealt with per Martinac in the extra scheduler type of analysis and the effects on his social and occupational lives that are contemplated in the Martinac decision. So the answer, Your Honor, is no. The tests relied on by the Secretary are good for finding out that pure tone. They're good for exactly what they say they're doing in the diagnostic code. But it doesn't go that extra step. It doesn't go the extra step of evaluating a person's disability picture that is contemplated in 4.1, 3.321, and 4.10.
Well, Counselor, stick with me on this, but the rating criteria for visual acuity does not list any symptoms. 38 CFR 4.79. So you're suggesting by analogy that the board must talk about the inability to see a stop sign, inability to thread a needle, or it's just lumped together as is the hearing loss as loss of hearing or loss of eyesight.
Well, there'd be a two-step analysis. It would be there's the visual acuity loss and the schedule, as Your Honor describes clearly. It's a lot like hearing loss. So it spits out, you put in your test results and it spits you out a non-compensable up to whatever percentage of requirement the visual acuity goes up to. Step one, which the board did here as well. Step one, here's what it spits out. Now, that veteran, you need to take the board, I should say, Your Honor, the board would need to take the effects of that hearing loss on his disability picture, which involves a social component, an occupational component. So, for example, Your Honor's example, he can't see a stop sign. Well, if he's a truck driver or lived a past life as a truck driver and he can't obtain employment because of that, or it causes him an inability to leave his house, which leads to another host of problems, well, that's important. And the board should discuss that. Now, whether that inability to see a stop sign leads to a compensable evaluation is for the board, the undersecretary of Veterans Affairs, or the director of compensation to properly adjudicate. But the board must, Your Honor, discuss that functional loss.
Mr. Stoltz, the appellant was asked to explain how his condition affected him in his own words, and the record indicates that he responded that he thought his hearing had decreased a little bit in his left ear. There was no indication of hospitalization. There was no indication that there was marked interference with employment. And quite frankly, I thought the explanation by the board compared to some I've seen was pretty good in dealing with the extra scheduler issues. But how do you square the veteran's testimony with your representations?
Well, the veteran's testimony has been analyzed by Your Honor a bit there. It's been analyzed a lot in the Secretary's brief. Mm-hmm. They offer a lot of analysis and actually get into record citations and what the veteran said. That's not in the board's decision, Your Honor. The actual analysis, they list it. There's no doubt that they list some of the things. But what is not in there, and Your Honor is correct, there's nothing that is as blatant as frequent hospitalization. I'm not actually, in all honesty, I'm not sure if there's marked interference with employment. There is interference with his employment. because that's what the February 2013 examiner found. There hasn't really been any more development on that, and that is perhaps another error in the case. But, Your Honor, the hearing testimony, the lay testimony, is not specific. It's not something that leads for necessarily an easy analysis, but it does lead to something of an analysis so that the board actually considers this. And, again, I get back to the embarrassment that this causes him because he did testify to that. He did testify to not being able to hear in noisy environments. He did have difficulty without the use of a hearing aid, finding the location of sounds, and hearing aids are not necessarily contemplated by the scheduler criteria, and this court has some memorandum decisions, I believe, that discuss some of that. The need for preferential seating, the need for him to not be able to use his right ear when he is on the telephone, all of these things are symptoms and effects of symptoms that the board simply did not get into as to whether or not there's something that are worthy of compensation or are worthy of at least a discussion or a thought about compensation. It never really went there. And in fact, as I pointed out, and I invite the court's attention again to the inherent kind of contradiction in the board's decision, because as Your Honor says, it lists some of these, but it says in the scheduler component, well, we can't put it under pure tone threshold, and then it, on page 13 of the record, says, well, we're not really going to consider it. So it's unclear from the board's decision what kind of what was going through this board member's head when he or she was actually adjudicating this, because it's just a list of some of the things that Mr. Doucette reported without really any analysis of the effects on his disability picture, which are the words that are used in the regulations.
Okay. Let's assume, I see you're out of time. Could you add two more minutes to the time, please? Let's assume for a moment that we accept your position that, in fact, this analysis was inadequate and it should be better. What guidance do you seek from the court regarding extra-scheduler analysis and discussion? What guidance do we provide the board? What guidance do we provide the bar? What would be your ideal discussion?
The court has explained a lot of extra-scheduler analysis. In Thun, it's explained it in Yancey again, it's explained it in Kupamala, it's explained it a bit in Wages. I believe that the court is offering guidance. I would say, since you're asking my opinion, that the Thun analysis be conducted. Thun is the controlling law in this situation. But that rather than just cite Thun and list out its steps, it actually gets into what it found to be competent and credible in this case, and find out what it is that Mr. Doucette's effects on his ordinary conditions of life and his disability picture are. Especially in a case, well, not especially, in every case, but in Mr. Doucette's case, it becomes so apparent because he's not getting any compensation under the schedule, and he does have this competent lay testimony of effects on occupation and effects on his social life. In fact, the board did recognize this when it remanded for TDIU. The board is still seeking, in this particular case, the board is still seeking development on whether or not his hearing loss contributes to his unemployability. Those findings, pursuant to the Brambley case from this court, are going to affect the extra scheduler analysis. So not only is it deficient on its face, it is also deficient given the board's own recognition that more development should be done in order to fully compensate or not compensate any more than the 50% Mr. Doucette has. The board has recognized that more development needs to be done itself. So why it didn't go that extra step in the extra scheduler analysis is unknown to me, because I believe, and our argument to this court is that its reasons or bases are so deficient.
Thank you, Mr. Stoltz.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. The court should affirm the Board of Veterans' Appeals' June 1st, 2015 decision on appeal that determined that appellant was not entitled to a compensable disability rating for his service-connected bilateral hearing loss and concluded that referral for extra scheduler consideration was not warranted for that condition based upon the facts of this case. As it related to its determination regarding referral for extra scheduler consideration, the board provided two separate reasons to support its determination. And unless the court finds both to be clearly erroneous, the board's decision must be affirmed. First, the board explained that appellant's hearing loss-related symptoms and their resultant effects were adequately contemplated by the rating schedule, and that therefore the first step of Thun had not been met. Secondly, it explained that even if its first step Thun analysis was clearly erroneous, and that is to say that if the symptoms and the severity of the condition were not adequately contemplated by the rating schedule, the related factors discussed in step two of Thun were also shown to not exist. In making these determinations, the board reviewed the symptoms and the complaints associated with his service-connected hearing loss and explained that the resultant effect of his symptoms in combination was difficulty hearing, which was typical and neither unusual nor exceptional for somebody with bilateral hearing loss. It further explained that any interference with employment associated with his bilateral hearing loss was best characterized as minimal and far from marked.
Mr. Snyder, do you agree with appellant's counsel that extra scheduler analysis should be done in all hearing loss cases?
Your Honors, I believe that any service-connected condition that is being considered as it relates to an increased rating should consider extra scheduler. That should always be a factor in determining whether an individual is being properly compensated. First and foremost, the scheduler should be considered, and just as equally, the extra scheduler, because in considering whether or not the rating code adequately contemplates any disability, not just hearing loss, it's understood that not every individual will suffer from the same symptoms, the same impairments as another individual, and the goal is to consistently and adequately compensate individuals based on their average impairment. So obviously there's going to be instances in any condition where the rating schedule is deficient. It may be medical literature hadn't been up to date when it was created. It may be that in population studies, individuals generally suffer from specific conditions based on X, Y, and Z, but B and C are also there but hadn't been included. So 3.321 allows for any deficiency in the rating schedule, which does not exist in this case, Your Honors. We would contend that...
Is that a yes or a no to my question?
That is a yes, Your Honor. Sorry for the ambiguity. As long as the condition has been service-connected. Obviously, if we haven't been service-connected, we're not reaching whether or not the scheduler criteria has been adequately analyzed and processed, so therefore we don't need to reach 3.321, but in any service-connected condition should consider extra scheduler.
So under Thun, as I discussed with your opposing counsel, one of the components is that the severity of the symptoms the veteran displays is a factor. How can the board or this court determine what the severity of the symptomatology is from the rating schedule when it just tells me somebody has 42 to 49 decibel pure tone average or 76 to 82% speech discrimination? How is the board or the court supposed to know whether someone can hear in a crowded room based on that kind of information to determine whether the rating schedule is adequately contemplating them for the severity of their symptomatology?
Your Honor, I believe it, especially in a case with hearing loss, it's a very unique condition. It's difficult to obtain exactly how each person is affected. The same results obtained by the testing scores could result in an individual not having much difficulty or could result in an individual seeming to have embarrassment based on the need to require repetition and things along those lines. We are striving to compensate everybody the same way. And the first step of Thun is whether or not the rating criteria contemplates the symptomatology. And as touched on minimally at this point, there's no symptoms involved in 6100. Most diagnostic codes will have explicit symptomatology associated with the condition. Hearing loss is very unique in the sense that we are attempting to verify the subjective complaints and to obtain an objective measurement that will allow us this consistent compensation. So the first question as relates to Thun is whether or not there is a disability or a symptomatology involved with distinguishing sounds and being able to detect those sounds as well. So if the symptomatology is related to that, then the first step has not been made.
But as we discussed, it's not just whether it contemplates hearing loss. It's whether it contemplates the severity of the hearing loss at that particular rating level. And, again, how is a layperson or the board or the court supposed to figure out what table matching these two boxes adds up to for translating to a person's severity symptomatology?
Yes, Your Honor. So the way this works, especially with 6100, is we look at the rating disability ratings available, and it does run the entire 0% to 100% that should contemplate all levels of severity of that disability. And again, hearing loss is a little bit more complicated because of the subjective nature of it. However, what we're attempting to do is determine whether or not the symptoms are contemplated. But obviously, as Your Honor is saying, that won't necessarily touch base as to the severity. And that's really ultimately, I guess, what the functional effects discussions is trying to ensure, that we are not missing the bases for, in this case, assigning a non-compensable disability rating.
But if the board in this case shrugs off the functional effects as just translating into hearing loss, and hearing loss is what we're already compensating, then it's not getting to the discussion that you're talking about of making sure that the functional loss is covered by the rating schedule or is not covered by the rating schedule.
Your Honor, in this case, while the board dealt with step one and said we don't even have to reach step two, had it stopped there, I think we would have a little bit more difficulty in responding in terms of the severity. But it's the step two analysis that the board ultimately did reach. It said, even if step one analysis is incorrect, step two is not met, and here is why. And I think that aspect of it is allowing us to determine whether or not the severity has been contemplated in this specific case. When it talked about the effects as it related to interference with employment, it explained that it was far from marked, and I believe it actually discussed it. And with all due respect to opposing counsel, I do believe it did more than just state it and then have a conclusion after stating the facts. It explained why it was far from marked and minimal in nature. And that allows us to reach the question as to whether or not the severity of the present case is not contemplated by the rating criteria.
Do you think the analysis of the two steps is conflated by the effect on employment as opposed to standing on their own, that we first look at step one and then we look at step two? Or are you arguing there is no prejudice because he didn't meet step two?
Your Honor, I would say there's no prejudice. I would also say it would depend on the facts of each case to determine whether or not the extra scheduler analysis fit the bill in terms of the symptomatology and the severity. And in this case, the board did go through all of the evidence to include the mentions of embarrassment. And that touches to what I was trying to explain with regards to a consistent application of the rating code. But in the instant case, there's no evidence that the severity and the symptoms were not contemplated. And so step one, we believe, has not been met. That being said, the board did go to step two and similarly found that that step had not been met either. So we would argue that either finding by the court unless found to be clearly erroneous, which I don't look at the evidence and see it as the board missing anything substantive that doesn't give us an adequate explanation and description of the claimant's disability picture.
So is are VA doctors misapplying Martinac in the type of functional effects that they are seeking if hearing loss related functional loss is already addressed by the rating schedule? Should they be asking veterans about other kinds of things like, I don't know, dizziness or trouble sleeping? And Martinac was an example.
Your Honors, that is exactly what Martinac essentially said. As long as the examiner has requested the functional impairments from the claimant, They've done their job. They're attempting to determine, especially in a case with hearing loss, they understand that the scheduler, mechanical application of the scheduler rating is going to result in a specific disability rating. But depending on the symptoms and the impairments associated with each individual veteran, may not adequately compensate or contemplate what that disability picture really entails. And so as long as the examiner does ask, and I believe in this case there was a specific narrative as to what was being asked and to request in the own words of the veteran what the effects are, the examiner has done his job. It's then the board's job to determine, looking at all the evidence, which in this case it did, exactly what the functional effects have been complained throughout the process. While admittedly in 2013 this was the only functional effect complained, the board noted the 2006 testimony. It's certainly possible that the symptomatology was fluctuating. It's also possible that while the examiner asked it and an answer was given, no additional information was obtained. So the board's job at that point is to ensure, based on the totality of the evidence, that the steps listed in Thun, if they have been met, to refer it, and if they haven't been met, obviously, to afford a proper adjudication based on those conclusions.
Counselor, would it be fair to state that your position is a discussion of the functional effects of an appellant's hearing loss in a scheduler analysis serves the same purpose as a discussion of those effects in an extra scheduler?
Yes, Your Honors, especially in a case with hearing loss, because the mechanical application doesn't actually require any discussion of symptomatology, it isn't technically required in the scheduler aspect. And I know in the August 2016 order, it was discussed whether or not the analysis had been performed in the scheduler portion of the condition of the board's decision. If the extra scheduler has to similarly repeat its discussion, and we would argue that as long as it's an adequate discussion is provided either in the scheduler or the extra scheduler portion of the board's decision, the function of the board's decision has been satisfied, and that means that the appellant has been informed as to the basis of the decision and allows this court to determine whether or not the board has provided that statement of reasons or basis adequately and facilitate judicial review. In this case, there was no discussion as it relates to the functional effects in the scheduler, but the board, in discussing extra scheduler, did discuss it. And as long as it appropriately referenced it, had that discussion actually just been transplanted in the scheduler, we would argue that the claimant had been informed adequately and that this board could review the board's decision to determine whether or not the board had provided such an adequate statement. Once the board really gets close to explaining that, and they say in the scheduler, without actually discussing the symptoms, there are these impairments, but they can't be converted into the mechanical application. And so really, they're ultimately not relevant. They didn't say that, but as it relates to the scheduler disability rating, they couldn't change the rating. It's the extra scheduler portion, especially in a condition such as bilateral hearing loss, that is to look at that in more depth to determine whether or not the 6,100 contemplated symptoms have been considered. And again, the mechanical application doesn't allow for any symptomatology. We do believe there is a distinction between listed and contemplated, also as discussed in the August 2016 order. We believe that Diagnostic Code 6,100 is a perfect example of that, because again, there's zero symptomatology. But logic and looking at the purpose and the effects that are being evaluated by the examinations and the objective testing done allows us to see that there are actually specific factors that are contemplated. And in hearing loss, it makes sense logically that it's difficulty hearing. And we would argue that anything having to do with difficulty hearing is per se contemplated by those tests.
You talk about the uniqueness of hearing loss, but is it really unique? Judge Lance had a discussion about visual acuity, I think range of motion testing in musculoskeletal problems. They also only list the subjective limitation that how far the veteran can move his or her arm. So everything else that's affected by that is not mentioned in there. So I think this discussion that we're having is actually far, far ranging and not just limited to hearing loss. And I think that makes it much more significant. But it troubles me to say that stuff that's not written down anywhere for somebody to look at when they're doing the assignment of a rating or reviewing what the RO did or us reviewing what the board did, how are we supposed to know what is contemplated versus what is written down?
Your Honor, first, again, in the present case, with the extra-scheduler analysis, they discussed what was contemplated, which is difficulty hearing, and explained why the specific impairments listed and complained of were, by definition, complaints with hearing. When I refer to uniqueness of the hearing loss, and I think this will apply as well to visual difficulties, what I mean by that is, in the present case, the veteran has distinct hearing loss in his left ear and no hearing problems in his right ear. And so when I refer to uniqueness in comparison to perhaps a musculoskeletal issue, an injured left hand versus an injured right hand, the right hand's health isn't really going to change the fact of the entire disability picture as it relates to his left hand disability. With the hearing loss and the testing and what we're trying to determine is, notwithstanding the discrepancy in the two ears, what do those two ears, when they are detecting the sounds, internalizing the sounds, and then communicating with the brain to exactly allow for how this person's hearing is affected, it is unique in that sense that a difficulty hearing left ear could be corrected by the right ear to a degree that a non-compensable rating is appropriate. And Diagnostic Code 6100 was not an arbitrary situation that was created. It was done after research, consultation with medical experts to determine you have a good ear, you have a bad ear, and the research suggests that when you take those two circumstances and put them together into one disability picture, notwithstanding the fact that we have a criteria Roman numeral 4 in one ear and Roman numeral 1 in the other, it still results in a non-compensable rating. And that's all I meant by unique. But I agree, ultimately, every case, not just bilateral hearing loss, the question has to be whether or not it is contemplated. And there's only...
Okay, well, getting then to the sort of the beyond that question, which is how are we supposed to know what is contemplated when it's not written down in the regulation?
Your Honors, I believe in this case it requires looking at the testing that is accomplished. And the testing that is accomplished is the ability to detect and distinguish the sounds. And that, therefore, is what is contemplated. Ideally, we would want every single condition to explicitly state what is being contemplated by that specific rating criteria so that we can adequately explain why an individual is getting compensated, what he is, or not getting compensated, notwithstanding the fact that he's got a service-connected condition. There are so many things that come into play there that I don't think it's realistic to be able to put it all down there, to say this is exactly what is being contemplated for every single disability. So there is some level of clarification that may be needed. It depends on each condition. Some conditions may be more logical, and some might be more covered by the rating criteria as it is. I believe that was discussed with regards to what's contemplated with musculoskeletal. There are limitations of motion is contemplated. And by definition or by extension from that, things that have to do with limitation of motion, putting on a jacket, taking off a jacket, being able to reach something, those are all contemplated, not explicitly stated, but by looking at exactly what we're compensating for can be reached. And the board's decision in the present case has explained exactly what was being contemplated by the rating criteria, notwithstanding the fact of specific symptomatology that is included in 6100, and then went that next step and explained why, even if that analysis may be flawed, step two is still not met, and the explanation is that it was far from marked, minimal employment deficiencies, and there, I don't see any evidence, and I don't believe appellant has alleged any hospitalizations, let alone frequent hospitalizations.
Mr. Snyder, because the scheduler rating is mechanically applied based on the speech discrimination and tonal differentiation numbers, doesn't that make the extra scheduler analysis even more important? Or would you agree that it does or not?
Well, yes and no, Your Honor. I would say it's always important. I wouldn't want to distinguish one condition versus another and say this specific that disability hearing requires more, but I think you're right. Logically, because there's no symptomatology actually noted there, it allows for, there's a need for a greater explanation as to those symptoms, which clearly isn't going to be covered in this mechanical application. But looking at the board's decision in this case, that was done. I think, Chief Judge Davis, you said that when you compared this extra scheduler with a lot of extra schedulers that you see, this was actually fairly informative, and I share your sentiment. When I was looking at this case initially, I was pleasantly surprised as to the extent that they went through the analysis, the alleged impairments, and then to not even stop at step one, which I see a lot sometimes, which opens the door for a remand if you don't discuss step two, and you say, well, step one hasn't been met, I'm not going to discuss it. And sometimes I see that, and depending on the case, you know, I can cringe, and I just know that there's something out there. When I looked at the evidence and I review it and I see it, well, that might be wrong. Well, in this case, the board explained, even if we're wrong, here's why step two hasn't been met as well. And so when I saw that, I did feel like the board performed its duties in a thorough manner that allowed for an explanation as to what it considered, compared that to what is contemplated by the rating schedule, and then went that extra step and explained that it furthermore doesn't meet that criteria that would require referral should both steps of THUN have been met.
I think you've anticipated my next question in your answer, but on a scale of inadequate to excellent in terms of the discussion of extra scheduler, based on your experience, where would this discussion fall?
Your Honor, this is one of the better extra scheduler analyses that I've seen, specifically because it didn't rest on its laurels with its step one analysis, and it went that extra mile. And when I look at that, I'm more comfortable knowing that the board member has evaluated the totality of the circumstances. And as long as that is not clearly erroneous, I feel comfortable defending that position before the court. I have certainly seen deficient extra-scheduler analysis. I've seen it in both regards with maybe a referral to previous evidence that wasn't necessarily discussed adequately. I've seen it in a very concise one paragraph, doesn't really get into it, and just says, based on the discussion previously, the factors, the symptomatology, the impairments are all contemplated, and therefore referral is not warranted. But without an explanation as to what those factors are, we're left to go back and figure out exactly what had previously been considered. Sometimes it's going to be sufficient, even if the extra schedule analysis is deficient in the manner that I just described. If it discussed it in the scheduler aspect of the board's decision and explained what the impairments are and explained either through a logical sense or through an explicit nature why those are contemplated by the rating schedule or not contemplated, then the job has been done. And it doesn't have to repeat that analysis in the extra scheduler portion, because we read board decisions as a whole. However, obviously, it's a case-by-case scenario. Looking to answer your question, Your Honor, looking at this specific case, I think this is a very adequate, one of the better extra scheduler analyses that I have seen.
Well, this is an important case in terms of the impact on veterans, and the numbers are large. A lot of cases have been stayed pending the decision in this case. So let me ask you this. What kind of guidance should this court offer as we draft the opinion here?
Your Honors, I think looking at THUN and looking at Gilbert is really what should allow for a clear explanation by the board. And by that I mean, with the analysis laid out in THUN, we know what is contemplated by scheduler and what is contemplated by extra scheduler. And with Gilbert, it explains why we're doing this. Why do we have an adequate statement of reasons or bases? And really, ultimately, it's twofold. We want the individual, the veteran in most cases, who served his country, to understand exactly why the decision has been rendered. If it's granted, I don't know how much an individual may care as to how they got there. But if it's denied, this individual needs to understand why it was denied. It also must allow for this court to look at it and say, well, has THUN actually been satisfied? And if the board's decision does not adequately allow for this court to determine step one, step two, have they been adequately considered, has the proper law been utilized, then that would have to require a remand. In this case, we don't believe that exists. We believe that the board fully explained why extra scheduler referral was not warranted. And again, did explain not just the one step, but the two steps, and therefore adequately accomplished what it needs to do to fully inform both the veteran and this court.
Could this board have done more regarding discussion and how the functional impairments affect the veteran's daily activities?
I would hesitate to say that it couldn't do better, but I think that's my own personality, where I always think that things can be improved upon. But we're not looking at whether or not this was the perfect decision. We're looking at whether or not it provided an adequate statement of reasons or bases, and that there's an explanation that will allow for individuals to understand and for this court to review it. And that has been accomplished. I think, obviously, just looking at the appellant's brief and the discussion and the supplemental memorandum, had the board discussed certain factors, then the appellant might have understood the question more. But it doesn't change the fact that the reasons or bases were adequate, that the law was followed, that FUN was followed. And again, when I look at this extra scheduler analysis and compare it to so many others, I do believe that the board did its job in this case.
Counselor, under the rubric of the real world, could you explain to me the administrative impairments and the results of this court requiring, as has been suggested, an extra schedule analysis in every hearing loss case?
Your Honors, I think what would require is almost exactly what we have in this case, where the board will explain what is being contemplated, and by hearing loss, that is difficulty hearing, and it certainly could explain that further. In other cases that I've seen, in this case, it really does lay that out, and then explain if there is that step one finding, go the next step and explain marked interference. And with hearing loss, that would require exactly what happened in the present case, where all of the complaints that are associated with this difficulty hearing, all the complaints should be enumerated to the best of the board's ability. Some records are so large that you can't really expect every single complaint to be there. And if something is not included, the board is presumed to have included it in its consideration, unless there's something in the decision that clearly shows that that's not the case. So in the present case, in a hypothetical, if the board didn't mention the 2006 hearing testimony and said this individual is not affected personally in any way, shape, or form, that would, you know, rebut that presumption that it had considered that evidence. But in terms of going forward with regards to bilateral hearing loss, the board should explain what is being considered, what is contemplated for that condition, and whether or not the specific complaints fit that category. And in the present case, that is not the case. Now especially in light of our discussion today, it would be helpful for the board to also reach step two in the event that step one is not found. But there is no requirement. It really is just this will allow for a more considered explanation that will perhaps avoid further appellate, further remand, further delays in adjudication and things along those lines.
Well, I was angling for the burden that we would place on the system if we were required an extra scheduler in each hearing loss case.
It would require a referral or just discussion, Your Honor.
I'm sorry.
I'm not sure I understand. Are you saying if every
let's assume that we adopt the counsel's suggestion, I believe he made, which is each hearing loss case requires an extra scheduler examination and analysis.
I'm sorry, Ron, I completely misunderstood your question. Yes, no, that would absolutely slow not just individuals with bilateral hearing loss, but veterans' appeals on a whole if it required that extra step, and especially if it required that extra step when the evidence doesn't reflect that such a step is needed. The cost, the time, the delay, I don't believe it's required under the law, and to require such a thing, I don't know what the effects throughout VA would necessarily be, but I don't think they would necessarily be beneficial for all parties involved, to include veterans and getting their decisions and getting their conditions adjudicated in a timely manner.
Tremendous congestion at the director's level, right?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Tremendous congestion would result from that.
Yes, Your Honor. In sum, Your Honors, because the rating criteria for hearing loss necessarily contemplates volume and pitch, we would argue, I see I'm out of time. If the Court wishes I can
summarize.
Thank you, Your Honor. The complaints of this kind would not be exceptional, and referral for extra scheduler consideration would not be warranted. And in conclusion, Your Honor, based on the discussion today and the brief and the supplemental memorandum of law, the Secretary respectfully requests that the Board's June 1st, 2015 decision be affirmed. Thank you, Your Honor.
Oh. Your Honors, I wish to clarify at least an important piece of this. I believe that we agree that a discussion of an extra scheduler analysis must be conducted by the Board of Veterans' Appeals. And I believe that we agree that that does not necessarily mean that each case must be referred then to the undersecretary or the director. So I want to make sure that I'm being as clear as I can be to say that what we are arguing for is an adequate discussion. And it appears that VA agrees that there should be an adequate discussion. And so therefore, I believe that the legal point that what is required of examiners in Martinac needs to be required of the Board of Veterans' Appeals, too, as far as discussion goes.
Let's just make sure we're all on the same page with that point. I think that's an important point. Counsel for the government, do you agree with that statement?
I really don't want to put words in my mouth. Right. So.
Yes, Your Honor, we believe that an adequate discussion in any case is required that would include extra scheduler, which is that play in all circumstances related to a specific.
Very good. I think that helps. Thank you.
And I want to be clear that appellant's position is not that every case must be referred,
right,
but there must be a discussion as to whether referral. So at the end of this very helpful argument, it appears that we agree on the point of law, and now it's about whether or not what the Board did in Mr. Doucette's case was enough. And it's our contention, and the reason that I say this is page 12 of the record is what I'm looking at, which after the boilerplate and the correct recitation of the law is really the heart of the Board's extra scheduler analysis, such as it is. And they do. Right at the top, they list out some of the symptoms and some of the causes of these symptoms on the hearing loss. Bear in mind that the Board already said these can't be converted to the rating schedule or pure tone loss. So they discuss this in the extra scheduler analysis in the right place. But there's really no analysis of any of this. What they do is they go into the next, they list it out, they go into the next paragraph. With respect to the aforementioned, the veteran's competency and credibility are not in dispute. It is reiterated that the applicable scheduler criteria assign an auditory acuity level to each ear based on pure tone threshold averages and speech discrimination percentages measured without hearing aids in a sound-controlled room. We agree with that. That's exactly what the diagnostic criteria involve. But then, without talking about any effects, it goes on to say the veteran's symptoms and the resultant effects are contemplated adequately by these criteria. So the key, it seems, is whether or not these things listed up in the paragraph above cause something additional to the hearing loss contemplated in the sound control room. It's our contention that they do. They cause something more than the simple hearing loss that is discussed in the diagnostic code. And without the Board, and it shouldn't be, and there are so many of these cases, as Chief Judge Davis pointed out, and there has been a lot of litigation about extra scheduler analysis, and the Court has offered a lot of guidance. We've discussed Gilbert, we've discussed Kupamala, we've discussed Yancey, some other cases. It's not that onerous. What the Board needs to do is it needs to offer some analysis of what this is. Do these things cause him some effect on his daily life? If that answer is no, it does not, after it talks about Mr. Doucette's disability picture, if that answer is no, and it is well supported by the record, then they do not need to refer it. If the answer is yes, either more analysis needs to be done by the Board, or it does need to be referred. The Board in this case recognized that there has not been enough development of Mr. Doucette's record. That's why it remanded the case to the board for more discussions on his occupational effect. Seeing as how occupational effect is a big part of the extra scheduler analysis, the board's implicit concession that it doesn't have complete information on this is important in Mr. Doucette's case. And so while we agree on a lot, which is very nice today, and I think very good for everyone, for VA and for the veterans seeking entitlement to compensation before the VA, we still do contend that this board decision, with all due respect to my colleague, is still deficient in its extra scheduler analysis, and we ask for remand. Thank you, Your Honor. If there's no further questions.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Stoltz.
Thank you, Chief Judge.
Normally, we would come down and greet counsel. Because of my lack of sure-footedness on the steps, I'm going to forego that opportunity today, but thank both counsel for your arguments. The case will be submitted for consideration. I would ask counsel to stick around for the question and answer session with the students.